Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Dr. Yang Jimian speech here at the Foreign Correspondents Club. My name is Keith Bradshaw. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the FCC Board of Governors. Before I introduce our guest today, just a housekeeping note, please turn off your cell phones or at least put them on mute. If everybody, I'll even pull out mine now so you can see that I'm checking mine too. Yes, it's muted. Please turn them off now. We do record this. We do put this up on our website, and we really would like to have a nice, clear audio for that and want to make sure everybody can hear. With that, let me introduce our guest today. He's been brought to us very kindly by the Foreign Ministry of the People's Republic of China, whose help we appreciate in organizing this event. His name is Dr. Yang Jimian, and he is one of the most famous and most influential foreign policy intellectuals in China. He has, for the past quarter century, been an influential voice on strategic thinking, on diplomatic thinking, both within Asia, on China's relations both within Asia and with the West. He studied both in the United States and in China, has a broad experience and broad base on which to comment on the particular challenges that we see in China today, whether it's the events in Tiananmen Square on Monday, the attack that has now been reported, or whether it's the broader shifts and challenges for China ahead with the approach of the third plenum. So with that, I give you Dr. Yang.
Thank you, Keith, for your very kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming. Hong Kong is such a busy place. You have a lot of choices to participate in different programs, but you decided to come. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure and honor to be with you, share some of my thoughts on China's diplomatic strategy and foreign policy under the new Chinese leadership as a Chinese scholar from Shanghai. First of all, I want to point out, in terms of foreign policy and global strategy, China provides more continuities than the changes and readjustments. But today, I focus on the challenges because of the limit of time. The world is changing very fast, and China is rising very fast. All these quick and fast changes present the following four challenges. Number one, rapid changes in domestic economics, politics, cultures, societies, etc., are calling for substantial transformations of China's domestic and foreign policies. Chinese integration with global economy has brought the entire Chinese people a part of the ongoing globalization, and thus resulting in multi-influence, and they reinforce each other. The second challenge is the international community is calling China's greater roles and responsibilities in global affairs. China is now the second largest economy in the world, if taking states as counting units, because if we taking other counting units, EU should be the second largest, the first largest economy in the world. China is a major player at such important global or regional organizations as the United Nations, G20, BRICS, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. China also works closely with the international community to cope with global issues ranging from anti-terrorism to climate change and energy security. The third challenge China is facing is that China's neighboring areas are complicated by a chain of events in recent years. We are confronting some challenges that we didn't have before. People now are concentrating more on the problems than the good news. The good news for China's neighboring areas and the country is that China has developed the largest economic ties with almost each and every neighbor country. And the good news is China has developed good symmetry and governmental and non-governmental relations with our neighbors. RMB goes everywhere. And the good news is more and more people are studying and speaking the Chinese language, Putonghua, but people just be attracted by the medias that the maritime disputes and some other troublesome spots. The fourth challenge is that China needs to match up with others on common and shared values. In terms of values, China is both unique and universal. On the one hand, China has developed our distinctive values in the past 5,000 years of civilization and the nation building, such as Confucianism, Taoism, and many others. On the other hand, China shares with the world on key values of the mankind. However, now we have the different expression of values and the natures of values. We should not be forgotten about that. So for these things create the new challenges to China's global strategy and foreign policies. Now, facing with these challenges, how China should meet them? Although the new leadership's diplomatic strategy and foreign policy is still unfolding, yet, at least, we can see the following four readjustments. Number one, China is attaching greater importance to strategic thinking and concentration. Mr. Xi Jinping calls on a number of occasions that China should focus on the strategic goal of building favorable external environments for China's modernization and the nation renewal, despite the difficulties and the distractions from time to time. Although there are many pressing issues in China's external relations, the new Chinese leadership stays on the trajectory of thinking comprehensively and in a forward-looking way. The overall strategic goals of the new leadership, in my understanding, are to build up more favorable environments for China's continued reform and opening up, preserve the nation's sovereignty, security, and development interests, and to promote peace, development, and win-win cooperation. The second readjustment is China sets strategic priorities by improving surrounding situation in the neighboring countries and promoting new model of major countries relationship. In past June, Mr. Xi Jinping and President Obama met at Sunnylands, California. There is a cultural difference. The Chinese writers would like to say Annenberg Estate, Sanzhuang. It gives you a lot of other thoughts in the beautiful Chinese language. But the Americans like the Sunnylands. Both are beautiful, but with different background. And at this informal meeting, the two presidents agreed to work together on building up the new model of major country relationship, and emphasizes on three things. Number one, no conflict or confrontation. Second, mutual respect. Third, that is win-win cooperation. These are not empty talks. These are not the new coined terms just for the politicians. Because in many Western writings, their historical memory traced back to more than 2,000 years ago, the so-called suicide traps between the rising and the established ones of essence and sparks. But Western writers, at least some of them, have had little historical memories of the Chinese ones. And about the same time, that was the Han Dynasty in China, when the Chinese establishments, the ruling elites, had agreed to make a Confucianism as the leading and the dominant thoughts of China. And Confucianism advocates for peace, virtue building, obligations, rather than military conquering. And by improving our relations with our neighboring countries, we have decided that China should invest more, not only in physical goods, but also in passionate feeling, culture, education, and to work together towards the community of common interests, common stakeholders, or even community of common destiny. And the third readjustment is China stresses more on the balance between seeking for practical interests and upholding virtues and obligations. Thanks to the three decades and more of reform and opening up, China has changed its formerly backward and poor situation to a relatively better off society by an only generation's time. Personally, I was a peasant during the Cultural Revolution, and starvation is still a living memory for me. However, my first trip to Hong Kong was in 1984, but now I feel much at ease to talk with my Hong Kong compatriots. Why? The two are narrowing our gaps, not only materially, but intellectually as well. And for this, China has accumulated a fairly solid foundation of material wealth and intellectual experience. These enabled China to work with the developing countries and the developed ones alike for win-win cooperation, such as interconnectivity of infrastructures, creation of new monetary and financial facilities, and even more choices for development models and systematic alternatives. China has expressed its readiness to shoulder more international responsibilities and obligations by more benefit and wealth sharing, first of all with our neighbors, but also with all the partners and the friends of the world. China is still a developing country, but the economic and the political nature of being a developing country increase rather than decrease China's conscientiousness of striving for common developments rather than avoiding more and bigger responsibilities. Last but not least, China seeks for greater internal and external coordination when planning and implementing diplomatic strategy and foreign policy. China is so big. China is so diversified, and China is going more and more pluralistic. We have got 1.3 billion people and different stages of economic and social development between coastal region and inland, and between the elite, the rich people, and the disadvantaged ones. China is fully aware of the fact that we are living in a world towards political multipolarity, economic globalization, cultural pluralism, and socialization of information. It is extremely imperative now for China to do a greater job in coordinating various interest groups domestically while building for communities of common interest with the other members of the international societies. China held the 18th Communist Party Congress about a year ago. So the new leadership is still working on its strategy, policies, and the related matters. The window of opportunity is here, and the leadership is very inclusive and absorptive to learn and hear from the academia and from the journalists, from the other groups and stratums of societies, both at home and abroad. And I think this is still an evolving and unfolding process. Ladies and gentlemen, to conclude, I would like to say, I often was asked, can China make sure to continue on the road of peaceful development once China is stronger and richer? Frankly speaking, it's very difficult to prove to vindicate something has yet to be take place. But I would like to say three factors. Number one, the leading philosophy of China's of the past thousands of years lay emphasis on peace, harmony with the world for the most of the time. Second, China's experience of being bullied, oppressed, and humiliated in the past two centuries most of the time. And according to Confucianism, we will not do unto the others what we don't want the others to do on us. And we know the feeling, the terrible conditions of being bullied and being oppressed. And what is more importantly, now we are having a very good start on the convergence of what the direction the nation should take and what we have to build to ensure it institutionally, philosophically, and physically, etc. So, in my opinion, any strategic and policy-wise readjustments of China's would stay on this lane in strengthening this general trends of not only China's, but the world's. Happily, in the 19th century and the 20th century, we saw the massive global-wide world wars. But since the end of World War II, in the almost 17 years, the world has avoided this kind of killings at the global level. So this gives us more confidence that so long as we continue stay on the right track, we can maintain the peace, stability, development, and the win-win cooperation of the world. Now, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Yang. If I may ask the first question then. The Beijing authorities are characterizing Monday's event as a suicide attack by jihadists using some kind of gasoline-based incendiary device. That sounds reminiscent of a lot of attacks that have taken place over the years in places like Central Asia. As China responds to this kind of an unexpected event in Tiananmen Square, do you expect a change in Chinese policies, particularly in Central Asia, particularly as the Americans start getting out of Afghanistan?
Thank you. I wrote two books on countering international terrorism. I knew so far this world has not had the consensus even on the definition of what constitutes terrorism. However, among all those about 200 definitions, one thing is in common. Any act against innocent people, especially the civilian, the women, the old people, the young children, is an act of terrorism. And China opposes all kinds of terrorism. This has been made very clear when 9/11 attacks happened. And now, this world is confronting with a lot of non-traditional security challenges, and international terrorism is one of them. China works with other responsible members of the international society to prevent, work against these expanding waves of international terrorism. So we hope we could work together facing with the post-2014 situation in Afghanistan, in Central Asia, by the way. And I came from Shanghai. The Shanghai Five later developed into Shanghai Cooperation Organization, put the terrorism and these ultra the religious and these things, three evil forces, even before 9/11 attacks. So China will continue to do this. And I hope that all the healthy forces in the world should work together. And only by so doing can we stop these expanding waves. Thank you.
If I may ask one more question on a different part of the world, partly, but also particularly with regards to Southeast Asia, the People's Daily mentioned that all seven members of the Standing Committee of the Politburo attended a meeting on regional diplomacy on October 24 and 25. That's the first time in at least 5 years we've had a report of all the members of the Standing Committee showing up for that kind of meeting. So it must have been something important, and yet the People's Daily report didn't give us much in the way of details. It just said it called for better regional diplomacy. What does it mean? What is the significance of that meeting? Do you see something new coming out of the third plenum? Why do we suddenly have the all seven members showing up to talk about regional diplomacy?
Okay. This is another good question. And I can read no more than you do. But I read more times than you do.
Yes.
And I watch the news of this important meeting 5 times. Then gradually I had 3 understandings of why China has had this important meeting. The official title of this conference is on the Central Working Conference on China's diplomacy with neighboring countries. According to Chinese formalities, if a nationwide conference named as a Central Working Conference, all the members of the Standing Committee of Chinese Communist Party Central Committee would be present. So this is not an exception. Second, why at this time? Because, as I said, in recent years, while we are making good progresses in strengthening and increasing our relations with our neighboring countries, we are confronting with the new challenges. While to cope with these new challenges, we should not only look at trees, woods, while forgetting the forests. We must look at it through a more comprehensive, strategic, and forward-looking ways. So this is why if you read the reports, I read it very carefully. That's my job. The participants were not only from the foreign ministry, from the financial, from many other sectors, as well as the regions, provinces, municipalities, etc. So this is a conference try to unite thinking and making the planning as well as the operational implementation for that. Thirdly, what are the new things coming out of this working conference? I think mainly three. Number one, the conference calls for more working together with our neighbors for common development. So sticking to, adhering to the road of peaceful coexistence and development with our neighbors comes the first. Second, the conference calls for participating in all spheres of cooperation, the economic, security, cultural, and even people-to-people relations. The third new things, as I understood as a scholar, that is to say, this will set a tune for the further development of China's global overall strategy, as well as other important fields of diplomatic relations with other parts of the world and in other semantical functional fields as well. So I'm being a scholar of think tanks on foreign and security studies. I'm really encouraged and hope there will be more such kind of working conference on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Florence?
Thank you. Florence de Changy, I report for Le Monde. My first question is about the general policy of China in terms of foreign affairs, and correct me if I'm wrong, I understand is no interference mainly. I mean, this has been a basic trend. How do you reconcile this no interference with China's rise? I mean, if China is as it is, second, number two, maybe number one, how long can it continue to say no interference?
Thank you. Non-interference principle has always been one of the few pillars for China's foreign policy since the founding of the People's Republic of China some 60 years ago. But at that time, China was weak. China was in somewhat self-imposed and outside-imposed isolation. So at that time, the danger was being interfered with. But now with going abroad and with at least 80 million person times every year, you can see Chinese anywhere and everywhere. Then China has already been closely integrated with the world. Then now we are facing with the two questions. One is still not to be interfered with. For instance, on the questions of Taiwan, of Tibet, etc. Because China, among all the major powers in the world, is the only one has yet to achieve fully and complete reunification. Please understand our positions and our feelings. The second is, with our interests overseas and our obligations, we are confronting with this. So the political sector, the governments are cautious, understandably. The academias are discussing, debating already, and some one famous professor from Beijing University, he suggests that in the future, China should pursue with the constructive involvement. There's some points in it. But to me, I think the principle is still there, but we can make some adjustments. And for instance, while preserving the principle of non-interference, we can discuss with the parties concerned what kind of role China should play. For instance, the United Nations decided that the whole international community should work against the piracy close to the Somali region. China sent the Navy forces over there. And when the parties concerned asked China to work with them and with the agreements and the consensus of our partners, we can do something all together. So I think this is something China is working on it, and but as a basic principle, we should be very careful and prudent. Thank you.
Francis.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. thank you very much for your presentation, which I think you would agree is one that emphasizes the positive. I think that when people question whether they can believe China's good intentions in the world sphere, they look at what is happening internally in China. And there we see crackdowns on lawyers, crackdowns on human rights people, crackdowns on journalists. We have seen journalists paraded out admitting guilt for something when they've not even been charged, let alone put on trial. And a business person who was the first one dragged out in his orange jumpsuit, Peter Humphrey, a longtime member of this club who is now on absent member status, but certainly someone many of us would know. So when we see these kinds of events, we question which China are we really looking at? Are we looking at the good intention one that's looking for win-win situations, or are we looking at the one that's putting foreigners and some of its own people in jail even without benefit of trial?
While I'm quite on the positive side, I'm not neglecting the negative side. Secondly, while we are discussing all these events, we should put them into a larger, more broader framework and a picture to understand. And thirdly, and we should not take the position that whatever the Chinese government is doing is unreasonable. For instance, some people, they do commit crimes, and they should be punished in one way or another. And the last but not least, China is working on the institutional building, legal building, and we hope that gradually China will go from rule by law to rule of laws, as well as become more transparent and more pluralistic. And please take the China's real conditions into our considerations. The United States was very free, but because of 9/11, they had very restrictive measures. And 2 weeks ago, I visited the United States. It was the time of the shutdown. But all these shortcomings or weakness of the United States or any Western open societies does not mean the strength, the good points of that. And I hope that if we have different views, that's natural and expected. We can work together and we can talk, but we should not naming and blaming or even do something even worse than that. So for this, I know the journalists' correspondents have the special sensitivities and keen eyes to that. And this is good. But let's listen to the other side of talking. Yeah, thank you.
Angie?
I'd actually like to defer my question and just open it up to some people at the audience.
Back in the corner, please identify yourselves.
Yeah, hi, David Lyon from the Economist Intelligence Unit. I'd just like to say the elephant in the room over China's peaceful rise appears to be its relations with Japan. So can you comment on how you see those developing and what measures may be necessary to prevent possible military conflict over disputed territory?
Thank you. As everybody knows, one can choose friends, but not choose neighbors. Japan is the third largest economy in the world and a very important neighbor of China's. China's relations with Japan in the past 1,000 years, most of the times, are very good, peaceful, complementary each other, except for the recent history, which we knew already. And now, we should point out that the recent wave of disputes triggered by the Diaoyu Islands was initiated by Japan first, not by China. And even with this case, China still continues to try to find diplomatic solutions. And 2 days ago, there was a Japanese scholar speaking in Washington, D.C. He disclosed that according to his knowledge, that the Chinese and the Japanese diplomats are still working on how to avoid the possible this incidental events or instances. And he said, Japan, the Japanese government, does not recognize there is a dispute. But further, he said, both Chinese and the Japanese words are rich enough to find some similar characters, kanji, to define this situation. China's rising peacefully is a solemn commitment by the Chinese government and supported by the Chinese people. Just think, if China always see what we had seen in Pakistan, in the Middle East, how could China developed in the past 30 years or so and reach the present level? The history has proved already the peaceful rising is the only way for the benefits of China and for the world. We will keep to that. Thank you.
Dr. Yes. Yang, I actually would like to follow up. Angie Lau, Bloomberg. You know, many say that China's modern day foreign policy is very much based on an economic one. You've expanded into Africa, Southeast Asia, and to welcoming arms at the front, and now dissipating into a little bit of anger and discontent. And we also have the latest from the US Treasury today saying that China's yuan is undervalued. How does China plan to deal with all these criticisms from an economic front?
First of all, China should learn from the United States to get used to be hearing from the criticism. This is not my invention. A lot of American friends advised us. Secondly, to look at these criticism, first of all, from the positive side. If people are criticizing you, you try to find out what are the good reasons, no matter how small they are, we should learn from. For instance, China is working with the African countries in a very good way. But China is doing a less good work of explanation, of publicizing to the outside world. And also, China could work not only with our African partners, but also with our Western partners, the third party, work together and to enlarge the points of overlapping interests, etc. And what is more, in China we have the saying, while the forests are large, you have all birds. So I do not want to deny there are very small number of people or interest groups, they are doing things badly, that these things that we should avoid it, to cure it, or even punish them. So for this, I would say, in the past 30 years, China pays the most attention to economic growth and relationship. In the next 30 years and beyond, China will pay more attention to other fields because China is growing. As I said in my kickoff remarks, the world is asking more obligations, responsibilities onto China. Thank you.
Thank you. Back here, Greg.
Yes, George Long. I wanted to ask you about the China's interest in the Middle East. Maybe if you can explain how, when China, for example, in the last 10 years, China's become very almost dependent upon oil from the Middle East. But China's also involved in talks about Iran and other things. So maybe if you can elaborate how you see China's interest in the Middle East.
China, I agree with you, is increasingly dependent on the energy supply from the Middle East. In the first few decades, China's relation with the Middle East was mainly political ones. China supported the Arab world, and China supported the Middle East peace process. But now China had a more economic, especially the energy interests, and China, first of all, will continue to maintain our good relations with both the Arab world as well as Israel. And secondly, and China will adopt a more proactive participation. But so far, China is still being kept outside of the main channels. That's the United States and the Europeans dominated ones. And thirdly, I think China would work with the whole international community that to face with the new challenges. First of all, with the shale gas, the revolution, what the United States will have the new orientation of its Middle East policies, and with the more diversification of China's energy supplies, and China how to do that. And with more China's enhanced capabilities, what kind of concrete the contributions China should make to keep the safety and the security of the transportation, and what China could do both at upstream and the downstream of the oil industries. And what is more is that the Chinese should be highly aware that we should not repeat some Western industrialized countries, the smog in some parts of China is really threatening. And I would call the attention of our own middle class people. Buy less cars, buy less houses, and to be green economy, energy, clean energy, etc. This is equally important, and I'm very much concerned about this, so the world can help us, and we can contribute to make the world, if we can do this, then China is making a greater contribution to the peace and stability of the Middle East. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's 2 o'clock and we do always try to wrap up now, but we appreciate all of your coming. This is our third day in a row with a sold out lunch. We had Michael Palin on documentaries in Brazil 2 days ago. We had Yung Chang yesterday on her books. And today we have, which has been a wonderful conversation about the diplomacy of China. Thank you very much for coming. We'd like to give you something to remember the club by.
Okay, yeah.
And we hope to see you all soon.